praising those who hew to the law, withdrawing to show anger, sending an endless string of prophets to attack sin through preaching that stirs up guilt, we continue to use the same tactics in society, pressuring conformity to what the majority believe is good, while disguising the evils that are done to the band of wrong thinkers, pacifists, radicals, communists, etc., who refuse to fall into line. Stage two isn't just a matter of naked power. It brings a sense of optimism to life. The world exists to be explored and conquered. Ego gives you strength, although its lessons are often painful. The Buddhist doctrine of ego death as a road to enlightenment is something most people cannot accept. It goes as follows. The more you center your life on I, me, mine, the more insecure you will become. Even worse, it makes you identify with externals, and that can only wind up leaving you empty inside. Convincing as the benefits of ego death may sound, few people would willingly sacrifice the needs of I, me, mine. In stage two, this is particularly true because God gives his blessing to those who achieve. In stage two, the ego is so bent on accomplishment that it ignores the threat of emptiness. Power for its own sake has no meaning, and the challenge of acquiring more and more power, along with its symbols in terms of money and status, still leaves a huge vacuum of meaning. This is why absolute loyalty is demanded by God at this stage, to keep the faithful from looking too deeply inside. The harder road would be to heal the disorder of our inner life. This is the choice that carries everyone from stage two to stage three. Anyone who finds satisfaction in being an accomplished, skilled worker will find stage two a very tempting place to rest on the spiritual journey. Often, the only ones who break free to a higher stage have had some drastic failure in their lives. Failure carries its own dangers, primarily that you will see yourself as a victim, which make the chances for spiritual progress worse than ever. But it does raise questions about some basic beliefs in stage two. If you worked hard, why didn't God reward you? Does he lack the power to bestow good fortune, or has he forgotten you entirely? As long as such doubts don't arise, the God of stage two is the perfect deity for a competitive market economy. However, there is still the problem of guilt. Despite its external rewards, stage two is associated with the birth of guilt. Someone has to lay down the commandments defining absolute right and wrong. Afterward, the law-abiding will enforce their own obedience. In the family, a 2-year-old who tries to steal a cookie is reprimanded by his mother and told that what he is doing is wrong. Until that point, taking a cookie isn't stealing. It is just following what your ego wants to do. If the child repeats the same act again, it turns into stealing because he's breaking a commandment, and some form of punishment will follow. Now the child is caught between two forces, the pleasure of doing what he wants and the pain of being punished. The child sets up his own boundaries. He will take a cookie when it is right, permitted by the mother, and not take one when it is wrong, causes guilt through a bad conscience. Freud called this the development of the superego, our internal rule maker. Stage two brings the comfort of laws clearly set down, but it traps you into putting too much value on rules and boundaries to the detriment of inner growth. It's no coincidence that a wealthy and privileged society is so prone to rampant addictions. Stage two is based on pleasure, and when pleasure becomes obsessive, the result is addiction. Stage two is also power-based, and power is notoriously selfish. The God of stage two is jealous of his power over us because it pleases him. He's addicted to control, and like human addiction, the implication is that God is not satisfied, no matter how much control he exerts. Psychiatrists meet people every day who complain about the emotional turmoil in their lives and yet are blindly addicted to drama. Other addictions are also based on behavior, the need to have something wrong in your life, or to create it if it doesn't exist. The obsession over things going wrong. This is the what-if addiction. And finally, the compulsion to be perfect at all costs. This last addiction has taken secular form in people who crave the perfect family, perfect home, and perfect career. They do not see that such perfection can be bought only at the price of killing our inborn spontaneity, which by its nature can never be controlled. There is a corresponding spiritual state, however, that aims to please God through a life that has no blemish whatever. In the loyalty oath of Psalm 101, the believer makes promises no one could live up to. I will set before myself no sordid aim. I will reject all crooked thoughts. I will have no dealing with evil. Such absolutism itself amounts to an addiction, and it is here in stage two that fanaticism is born. The fanatic must purify his very thoughts. Complete control over the mind is unachievable, but this doesn't prevent him from imposing ever stricter vigilance on crooked thoughts, his and other people's. Those who get stuck in stage two lose sight of the actual goal of spiritual life, to free humans and allow them to live in innocence and love. This cannot be repaired until the devotee stops being so concerned with the law. To do that, he must find an inner life, which will never happen as long as he's policing his own desires. When a person begins to see that life is more than trying to be perfect, the bad old desires rear their heads again. Only this time they are seen as natural, not evil, and the road is open for stage three. It comes as a source of wonder when turning inward breaks the spell of I, me, mine, and ends its cravings.